Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms both in the system and within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really happy today to be able to talk with Barry Swicker. Barry has just arrived here in San Francisco from Toronto, where he lives and where he works as a media critic and broadcaster. He works with Vision TV. He's been working for many years as a journalist and as a professor of journalism, too, journalism and communications. And most recently, Barry Swicker has a show on Vision TV called Eye Opener. This reaches 8 million people, I understand, Barry. That's really great.
Well, no, it could reach 8 million people, potentially. In fact, more than that, because our channel goes into 8 million households. We're one cable channel among 72, so we don't know how many we have. But our listenership, our viewership is going up. And we probably have a respectable couple hundred thousand people we reach. That's about it.
Yeah, well, that's really good. Especially, it's wonderful that you're getting out this information that so many people on the media or anywhere don't talk about at all. Well, I've got to tell people first that you're a bike rider, and you're 4 years older than I am. You were born in 1934. I am impressed. And you just rode your bike across Canada. How many miles, or almost all across Canada?
I have done two-thirds of Canada. And a couple of summers ago, I went from the West Coast, from Vancouver Island to Calgary. And then the next summer, I flew back to Calgary and picked up and rode to Toronto. And I think that was around 6,000 kilometers. And I do solo. I have a trailer. I love it. I just love getting out. At one time, I was in the southern mountains of BC. I didn't see another human being for 2.5 days because I ride off-road as much as I can on the Trans-Canada Trail. And it's a joyous thing, and I'm just glad I have the health I can do it.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. I'm glad you do, too. And you're working on a book called Connecting the Dots, The Media, 9/11, meaning September 11th, and Our Future. And you've also produced a videotape called The Great Deception, which is some of your television shows put together into a videotape that people are able to get. And this whole subject of September 11th and what really happened, and is it the same as the government's telling us? And, of course, I don't think it is. That's why I'm interviewing you here and why we're all getting together. So I think it's best to just leave it to you to explain to the audience how you came to get involved in this and what you think's going on.
Well, it's interesting when you say how I came to get involved in it. We were having supper tonight, a whole bunch of us, and the nature of belief, the nature of our preconceived beliefs was part of the conversation. And I've talked to different people who are what we call 9/11 skeptics. That is, people who believe that this was an inside job, that this wasn't according to the official narrative of the White House.
Let me just say, I mean, there's an outside chance somebody doesn't know what we're talking about. We're talking about the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings and another building, and the something happened to the Pentagon, that's for sure, on September 11th, 2001, and that's the issue here.
Thank you, Sue. I rushed into too quickly, and it's true. You can confuse a listener.
Right. No, it's me. It's not you. It's my job. But anyway, just to make very sure that people know what it is we're talking about here.
That's right. We're talking about the events of September the 11th, 2001. Now, there's an official narrative, an official story about that. And, we've got a fire siren going outside the window there. And it is that these 19 swarthy Arabs, these homicidal maniacs, who allegedly just hate the democratic way of life, etc., did this all by themselves, and they caught the whole of the intelligence and military and political establishment with their pants down. And so that is, frankly, I thought, frankly, implausible. It doesn't add up. I'm one of the 9/11 skeptics, so-called. But you ask, how did I get involved, or why would I think that?
Yeah.
Well, why would I think that? Why would I be suspicious when millions of people aren't? Why are a lot of us suspicious when millions of people aren't? And there are different reasons why people are suspicious. I've been asking them about this because, as you've noted, I'm writing a book about it, about the nature of belief. And I think that those of us who haven't been, and those of us who haven't just bought hook, line, and sinker, that general conception, I think it's called American exceptionalism, which is that America only does good. Well, sometimes America has to do something that's kind of bad when we're forced into it, but we really mean well. We're a moral force in the world. We're for democracy. We're for liberty. We're for freedom. Well, you know, there are a lot of people just can't accept all those high-flown abstractions, and I'm one of them. And we've seen, those of us who have opened our eyes to see it and to hear people like Noam Chomsky and others tell, that there have been a lot of horrible intrusions done by U.S. military on instructions from the Pentagon and so forth over the years in Chile, for instance, where the democratically elected government was overthrown. It's all come out and is documented. The Nixon White House did it, killed the democratically elected president, Salvador Allende, brought in 17 years of horrible rule by the Pinochet military junta. And that's just one example. And we know there's Grenada. We know there's Haiti. There's Vietnam, Indonesia, and on the list goes. Now, I'm not being in the least bit anti-American here. I'm really not. I love this city. I have close relatives, friends in the United States. I worked in the United States for 2 years. I love Mark Twain. I love Tennessee Williams. I love New York City. I love San Francisco. I love the Grand Canyon. I love the Cleveland Pops. I can do without your beer. Okay. And so I'm not being anti-American in this. I'm talking about militarism. I'm talking about state terrorism practiced by U.S. forces. And so if you have a background like that, where you know these things, and these things have concerned you for a long time, and if you also are aware of a bit more history, like it's probably just as well that you mentioned our ages. 1934 I was born. So I was I'm younger, no doubt, than some of your listeners, but I'm older than most. So that the Second World War, although I was too young to go and fight in it, my father was in the Royal Canadian Air Force. He was a squadron leader. But, of course, I was too young. I was something like 12, I guess, when the Second World War ended. But, boy, I learned a lot about it. And I learned that the Nazis arranged for the German parliament, which was called the Reichstag, to be burned down. It was a trick. It was a highly iconic and remarkable event in Germany. And it was something that helped catapult Hitler to power. It was a great big deception. It mobilized public opinion because he blamed it on the communists. There's always a scapegoat in these things. And so I immediately saw a parallel with the Reichstag fire. And, of course, if one knows the history of these deceptions, I say these deceptions because there have been so many. I'll just mention a few, if I may. You had, triggering the Spanish-American War, you had the explosion in Havana Harbor of the USS Maine, which has never been adequately explained. It was known that the government of the day wanted that war. It was known that the newspapers of that day wanted the war. And it was very convenient that that American ship blew up. There was a loss of life, 200 and some American sailors, and it triggered the Spanish-American War. Spanish-American War resulted in the United States having more territory, such as the Philippines, after the war than when it began. Earlier, the Mexican-American War was started for a very inconsequential reason. Then you come up to, say, the Pearl Harbor. Now, this all may be very difficult for some listeners to credit, but this, in fact, is all documented. And this is not, I repeat, this is not anti-American talk. You come up to Pearl Harbor, there's a wonderful book by Robert B. Stinnett, S-T-I-N-N-E-T-T, who was in the U.S. Navy during the Second World War, served with distinction. He thought there was something fishy about Pearl Harbor, and after the war he began to research it. It took him 17 years to write the book, Day of Deceit. And he had 200,000 documents declassified about the Pearl Harbor attack, and he interviewed everybody who could possibly be interviewed. And he came to the conclusion that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt not only knew that the attack on Pearl Harbor was going to happen because they had broken the Japanese codes and they were able to intercept the radio traffic between the ships in the Japanese armada, but it was more than that. He knew it was going to happen, and arranged, by the way, for the officers, the chief commanding officer at Pearl Harbor, to not do anything. This information that there was a Japanese armada approaching was not, N-O-T, not shared with the commanding officer there. And in fact, the commanding officer was hearing things that, after all, it was 1941, there were all airplanes, it was radio, I guess radar was starting, and I don't know if there was sonar, but anyway, word got around. And when the commander said, I'm hearing things, that there's something afoot, that maybe we're in some kind of danger, something's cooking, he was told by Washington, no, there's nothing, you just do nothing, don't worry, and the information was withheld. So that was the nature of it. But why were the Japanese attacking in the first place? Well, they were deliberately provoked. Now, I'm not saying the Japanese would not have attacked without the provocation, but when you read this book, Day of Deceit, you find out they were provoked. That Franklin Delano Roosevelt had a trusted lieutenant named McCollum, and he asked him about a year before to figure out a way the Japanese could be drawn into a war, because FDR had wanted all along to join Britain and Canada and other allies in fighting the Nazis. And it was 2 years into that war, and the United States wasn't doing anything about it. And Roosevelt wanted to help Churchill. He wanted to help England. The war was very, very serious. I mean, Hitler could have won. And yet the American people, only 14% of them, according to the Gallup poll, were in favor of going to war. And most of the American corporations were not interested in going to war with Hitler at all, because, frankly, they were very favorable to Hitler's project, which is strongly anti-communist and very, very capitalist. And so Roosevelt was in a bit of a bind. He went with his fireside chats. He went on speaking engagements. He did everything he could to try to talk the Congress, the American people, political establishment, into America joining that war. And Americans were just not having any part of it. As I say, 14% of them only, according to the Gallup poll, before Pearl Harbor, supported going into that war. After Pearl Harbor, 1 million American men volunteered the next day to join the armed forces. Mm-hmm. That is how mobilizing these great events can be. And we can see how mobilizing 9/11 was. It gave a huge boost to the agenda of the Bush administration, which was already on a course of rather aggressive projects in the world, as far as trade is concerned, and also militarily, and as far as acquiring resources one way or another is concerned. But the 9/11, because it was such a shock to the American people, became and remains the main justification, the linchpin for the so-called war on terrorism, a real all-purpose thing. And in turn, the war on terrorism is the foundation for these hot wars, where you get the very dangerous point of American military might, as in Iraq, and we don't know how many more countries. This whole foundation of really extravagant aggression all rests on that, on the official narrative about 9/11, that foreigners did it to us, whereas there's every reason to believe, regrettably, that the Bush administration was complicit in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's why, of course, that I think it's so important to be talking about and the subject of what really did happen with September 11th. And it's interesting because it is, I mean, all this other stuff, these horrors that are going on, in at least they're horrors in my mind, and these get those guys over there, get those Arabs, those Middle Easterners, you know, get them here, get them there. And a lot of people by now, I think it's about oil, not really about, you know, well, they know that, but it just seems like such an important point. And as you say, there have been so many examples, and people even writing straight out about the way to get a country to unify is to get an enemy. So that works every time. But, of course, because there's so much repression that comes along with it, and I didn't even know about the Reichstag fire. I didn't remember. But I certainly, you know, have a feel for the rise of Nazism from just studying, or I don't know why. And I've been noticing that kind of vibe happening more and more in the United States. I mean, with all the people in prison, with the repression. And for me, when I saw that picture of Osama bin Laden within such a short time after the towers fell, you know, I thought, well, how come they had that picture there so quick? And how do they know if they knew how it is? You know, why didn't they stop? But before I was even thinking, the whole thing just smelled funny to me. But people have a lot of resistance against that. And I guess it's not like we know exactly the answers to everything, but we know questions and some answers and enough to wonder. And so tell us more, Barry Zwicker.
Well, you don't have to know all the answers to know that a big answer you're given is a lie. You see, you don't, and it'd be very hard to know all the whys and wherefores and all the intricacies of these deceptions. There are some things that will never be known about all sorts of subjects. But one thing is that when things don't add up at all, then you're absolutely, you must intellectually and morally ask, well, what has really happened here? What kind of a purchase can we get on the reality of this thing? Because it's just extravagantly ridiculous that no U.S. Air Force jet interceptors turned a wheel until it was too late that day. That alone, for any thinking person, just really has to cause us to disbelieve the official narrative. The fact that they came up with a perpetrator within 2 hours of the events, a perpetrator, by the way, that then later they said, well, they knew so little about that they couldn't predict he would have done it. Well, if they knew so little about him that they couldn't predict he would do it, how would they know within 120 minutes that he did it? That's just on the face of it, that's absurd. Now, but one thing here, and people all over the world probably would recognize this conversation we're having. The thing that I'm working at with my book is really the nature of belief. Let us say that there's some people listening right now who concur that it's just unfathomable that the jet interceptors over in a drama in the skies that took almost 2 hours to unfold. Why when there were 26 air bases nearby, when they're all, it's a standard thing to scramble without getting anybody's permission once you're told that an airliner has lost radio contact or has gone seriously off course or any number of things that are all written down in the FAA rules about emergencies. So let us say somebody agrees with us that is really fishy. Let us say somebody agrees with us that it's really fishy that they would name a perpetrator about 2 hours after the events. But then the question arises, well, that information is available to everybody. It's not like it's secret. That is common information. Like virtually everybody watched TV that day. So this is a puzzle then. Why did I, on the very day, say this is fishy? Other people said that's really fishy that day, the day after. Some people at our dinner tonight said, one guy said it took him 5 months, was it? Something like that. But came to the conclusion it was fishy. Most people, within days, or maybe a week at the most, with the same information that all the other millions and millions and millions of people have. Why do these other millions and millions and millions of people not think it's fishy too? I mean, so I don't want to be down-putting because maybe the majority of listeners are among those. So I don't want to be discourteous to any individual person, let alone a complete radio audience. But I do find it very puzzling, and it has something to do with the nature of belief. It has something to do with a whole field of preconceptions, maybe, that one's country can do no wrong, or that one's leaders should always be trusted. And I think, frankly, although I'm a Canadian, that's a peculiar thing to think in this country, the United States of America, which started off with a constitution and a style of government and a set of values that were very, very worried about government being too strong because this country broke away from being a colony of Britain because Britain had become tyrannical and was exercising taxes and so on that it shouldn't have and so on. That was the beginnings of this country. Surely some of that spirit should be left. I think a larger fraction of Americans really should think about this because it is being used as the fuel for burning up billions of tax dollars on very dangerous projects.
Instead of what things are needed for, actually, in fact. And also, we better hurry up and get this clear because we don't have so much time as we used to. Things come out, if they come out at all, 20, 25 years later. But at the rate things are moving in terms of the survival of humans and all many other living beings on the planet, we are not going a good direction.
No, that it's not any time for business as usual. I think there's something called speed up. We see this in many fields. Speed up. Marshall McLuhan talked about this back in the 60s. We see it in the field of reproductive technology. We see it in biology and nanotechnology, weapons development. We see it in communications. And we're just seeing it simply in world affairs, military hardware and so forth. There's a speed up in the affairs of that things happen now in years that used to take decades, or they happen now in months that used to take years, or they happen in days now that used to take weeks. There's so much that's instantaneous. And so at the same time, the despoilation of the planet in so many ways, declining fish stocks, forests being clear cut, soil erosion, air pollution, ultraviolet rays, the ozone layer, and so on, that there's speed up, too, in the deterioration of the planet. And it's like a tapestry, they say, that you can pull out a certain number of threads in a tapestry, and you can still see the design, and you can pull out more threads, and the tapestry is still hanging there. But then it comes the time you pull out one more thread, and the whole thing collapses. And that's the nature of environmental collapse. And the military, by the way, are the worst polluters in the world, yeah. And they're not subject to pollution laws. So that's a doubly sad thing.
Yeah. Well, there's so many sad things, of course, and we can't usually even talk about them on the corporate media in the United States and much of the world. Somebody, Tim Robbins, is that his name, was just taken off of Nightline, and Peter Arnett was just fired, and there's all kinds, a bunch of independent journalists were killed over in Iraq, which didn't seem to be accidental at all. So freedom of speech is going fast, and I wonder if it's a little better in Canada, and then we're just going to have to end this interview pretty soon and hope that we've opened some people's minds.
Well, it is a little better in Canada because we have the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which happened to be government-owned. It has an independent board of governors, and so ownership really matters so much in the media, and that's why stations like yours are so important, because they're not corporately owned. But I think we should try to end on a note of positivism, if we could. There is hope. I really believe there's hope. There's a great waking up of public opinion around the world. A lot of people are seeing through the hypocrisy, through the lies. There's something called cognitive dissonance, where someone says, I'm liberating a country, but it looks to a lot of other people like it's being occupied. And so people are actually asking those questions, and there's great hope in that. When people wake up, and I'm not saying I'm awake and everyone else is asleep, but I think generally when we all wake up and start asking questions, start taking more action in our own lives to control our own destiny, not depend on just going along with what authorities say, especially when they're spouting big platitudes like freedom and democracy and so on, then we're all the better for it. It's more of a democratic feeling when we do more questioning, and dissent is patriotic, especially if you see terrible things happening. It's unpatriotic not to dissent.
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to let people know how they can get your video and more information, basically, Barry Zwicker.
Well, probably the simplest thing is that I have a phone number where I take orders for the video, and it is area code 416, that's Toronto, 416, and the number is 651-5588. 651-5588, and that's the key. I don't have my own website, and I won't be back in Toronto for a week or so, but a message can be left. That's the key.
Right, and there are very, very many websites. Also, go to the deceptiondollar.com. That's just like it sounds, deceptiondollar, one word, .com. And you will see these wonderful dollars that are covered with websites. And the War on Freedom is a good one. That's also one thing. TheWarOnFreedom.com is a website. Another one is WhatReallyHappened.com. And another one is UnansweredQuestions.org. So there is information available on the internet, and the War on Freedom is also a book. There are some books. There is some information around, and get connected with this very, very important issue of finding out what really happened on September 11th, 2001. So thank you, Barry Zwicker.
You're welcome, and I would say get connected and connect the dots.
Right. Okay, and my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, SUESUPRIANO.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.